apologize for the vagueness of it, but this is a different process because of the nature of the timing.
Bill Walker announces his transition team from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 12th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Locke here. Also tonight, insurers preparing for the open enrollment period on healthcare.gov aren't expecting a lot of new business.
Just in general, the individual market is extremely price sensitive. So in an environment where prices are going up, you're going to probably have more reticence to jump in.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Division of Elections counted 20,000 outstanding ballots yesterday. When they turned the machines off at 10 p.m., unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker had increased his lead to 4,000 votes over Republican Governor Sean Parnell. With a Walker win looking more likely, a transition team is being formed to prepare for a December 1st inauguration. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Bill Walker and his Democratic running mate, Byron Mallott, were quick to name the leaders of the transition team at a Wednesday afternoon press conference at their Anchorage campaign headquarters. First came Anna Hoffman, co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, CEO of the Bethel Native Corporation, and a Democrat. Next, they introduced Rick Halford, former president of the state Senate, resident of the Bristol Bay Area, and a Republican. But that's about as specific as they got on the transition team. After already being pushed multiple times by multiple reporters to explain what exactly the team wanted to accomplish, Rachel DeOro from the Associated Press again asked for a game plan, this time from Lieutenant Governor candidate Byron Mallott.
I'm feeling that it's just a little vague from what all you've said. Concretely, what is this team going to do? Are they going to come up with a list of possible personnel? What is the end result going to be of this team?
You know, that's something we've pondered ourselves.
Walker and Mallott clarified that the transition team will not be tasked with selecting commissioners, but they themselves will separately name a cabinet within days of formally winning election. Walker said he had talked with Governor Sean Parnell about what the logistics of a transition would look like. Transition team co-chair Anna Hoffman says her team's focus will instead be on policy.
Arctic policy and climate change, consumer energy, corrections, economic development, education, fiscal policy, and fisheries. Of course, these are all very large, significant topics.
Co-chair Rick Halford added that the idea is to get stakeholders in those areas to hash out possible courses of action, and there will be more specifics once the race is called.
A transition is vague, and it's particularly vague when you don't have final results and you have a week or two to deal with the entire issue. So yes, you're right, it's vague. But you shouldn't be afraid to ask a question because the question's vague and the answers may be vague.
Walker himself echoed that point.
I apologize for the vagueness of it, but this is a different process because of the nature of the timing.
Walker also emphasized that even though a transition team is being formed, the campaign is still waiting on further results from the Division of Elections. The Parnell campaign plans to do the same. Election workers will count more absentee and question ballots on Friday, with counts also scheduled for next week if necessary. More than 30,000 ballots still need to be processed. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Republican Dan Sullivan has a persistent lead in Alaska's U.S. Senate race. Today, according to his campaign spokesman, he's en route to Washington, D.C. After more votes were counted yesterday, Sullivan still leads Democrat Mark Begich by about 8,000 votes. While Begich hasn't conceded, the former attorney general seems to be claiming his victory. I am deeply humbled and honored to serve my fellow Alaskans in the United States Senate, Sullivan said in a written statement early today after AP declared him the winner. Campaign spokesman Mike Anderson said Sullivan plans to participate in Republican organizing conferences tomorrow. Meanwhile, in the U.S. Capitol today, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell met with the incoming GOP freshmen, minus senators-elect from Alaska and Louisiana.
We're really excited about having a great new bunch here, and we hope they're going to be joined by Dan Sullivan and Bill Cassidy shortly.
The new members of both parties are meeting this week for freshman orientation. They don't take office until January. The three-month open enrollment period for the Federal Health Care Exchange begins this Saturday, November 15th. The two insurers offering plans on healthcare.gov in Alaska have very different projections on how many people will sign up for coverage for 2015. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Health insurance rates on the exchange are going up a lot in Alaska. Jim Grasgo is president of Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera's rates are increasing an average of 37%. And Grasgo says because of that, he doesn't expect to attract many new customers.
Just in general, the individual market is extremely price sensitive. So in an environment where prices are going up, you're going to probably have more reticence to jump in.
Grasgo points out the vast majority of people who buy insurance on healthcare.gov receive a subsidy, which should cover a lot of that increase. The company is also working with the state on a plan that would make individual rates more affordable in Alaska. Primera currently has about 7,000 customers in the state who bought Affordable Care Act insurance plans. That number fell far short of the company's ambitions for the first year. And for 2015, Grasgo's goal is a lot more modest.
You know, we're hoping that we can maintain what we have, to slightly grow what we have.
Moda Health, the other insurer on the exchange in Alaska, is more optimistic about enrollment. Moda's prices are increasing an average of 27%, but Moda's insurance plans are generally more affordable than Primera's. Jason Godey is with Moda's Alaska office. He thinks the company will gain thousands of new members during open enrollment.
We believe that there is still a large number of people who are uninsured in Alaska who maybe did not sign up last year in the open enrollment period. So we're expecting that there will be another increase in enrollment, but certainly how many is, it remains to be seen.
Nationally, the Department of Health and Human Services is expecting at least 2 million more Americans to sign up for health insurance in 2015. Right now, about 7 million have Affordable Care Act coverage. The open enrollment period lasts until February 15th. After that, you can only sign up for health insurance if you have a qualifying event, like a move or a divorce. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new study predicts increased flooding for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
I'm anticipating that most of the permafrost in this region will disappear in the next 30 to 50 years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
There was a hearing in the Fairbanks 4 case on Monday. The hearing in state court was requested by the Alaska Innocence Project, which is attempting to overturn guilty convictions of George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, the four men imprisoned for the 1997 beating death of John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Alaska Innocence Project wants statements allegedly made by former Fairbanks resident Jason Wallace to his lawyer about John Hartman's killing unsealed. The Innocence Project contends Wallace, who's jailed for another murder, said things that corroborate the recent confession of former friend William Holmes. Holmes was also imprisoned for an unrelated killing, claims he and a group of friends, not the Fairbanks Four, randomly targeted Hartman, and Wallace delivered the deadly blows. The hearing on whether attorney-client privilege should be broken was close to the public, but dozens of Fairbanks Four supporters gathered outside the courtroom. Marvin Roberts' mother, Hazel Mayo, expressed hope that Wallace's statements will be released.
We're just all have our fingers crossed that the judge makes the right decision on this. Maybe there'll be justice for the boys sooner.
Requests for post-conviction relief for the Fairbanks Four submitted a year ago center on Holmes' confession and potential corroboration by Wallace. It's unclear how long Judge Paul Lyle will take to issue a decision on the sealed documents, but he must do so within 6 months. John Hartman's brother, Chris Kelly, has said he and his family believe the Fairbanks Four are guilty. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A new study shows there could be more frequent and more violent storms accompanied by increased flooding and erosion in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta over the next 50 to 100 years due to climate change. The study by researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey and the University of Alaska relied on remote sensing technology along with observations from local native people. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Alaska scientists used satellite images to look through clouds during storms and for the first time could see how far tidal flooding on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta extended inland. It was much farther than they imagined.
It's really extensive. It can go just about 20 miles inland during these really large storm events, so it covers a very large portion of the outer delta.
That's Tor Jorgensen, a landscape ecologist and adjunct professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and co-author of the study. Scientists examined storm flooding events in the Bering Sea region of western Alaska from 1913 to 2011 and found that the largest events occurred in autumn and were associated with high tides and strong southwest winds. The data allowed them to map and document the extent of the region's flooding for the first time. Jorgensen's projections show sea level could rise 1 to 3 feet in the region over the next 100 years, and that the region will likely see an increase in the frequency of flooding in coastal areas to a monthly basis. The study also looked at the retreat of sea ice, Jorgensen says, because it dampens the effects of storm surges in the winter. A delay of freeze-up of the Bering Sea during the winter could allow big storms and significant surges to extend into December and January. Dr. Craig Ely is a research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and co-author of the study.
Over a couple days, what happens is the tide comes up and then the wind pushes the tide inland even more. And then the winds are so high, the tide doesn't get a chance to leave. And so the water just basically builds up over a couple days. And, you know, I've been out in some of the smaller storms when we've been sort of stranded out there and there's just no low tide and it keeps getting higher and higher.
Winter storms could have huge impacts, freshwater habitats converting to saltwater ones, heavy sediments smothering vegetation, low-lying permafrost plateaus collapsing, and villages eroding away. 81-year-old Leo Moses of Chivac was born about 30 miles south in Kashunik, where he remembers a huge flood changed everything.
And then after the flood had gone for some years, the village itself started to sink. I think it was that the permafrost underneath the village was melting, so it had nothing to hold it up and started to sink. Start sinking it.
The flood forced the village to move to Old Chivac in the mid-1940s when Moses was about 7. The BIA then moved the village to what is now Chivac. Moses says he has no doubt he's seeing climate change.
Yeah, I'm seeing climate change every year. Man, the permafrost is growing. Eventually, we won't have any permafrost and ice up north, the ones that never used to melt, start melting and there's more water. What kind of future we have, I have no slightest idea.
Jorgensen points to the village of Newtok, the first modern western Alaska village to initiate their own relocation to Nelson Island due to climate change. Jorgensen says warming temperatures and increased flooding will impact the YK Delta region in his lifetime.
I'm anticipating that most of the permafrost in this region will disappear in the next 30 to 50 years.
And storm surges help accelerate this loss by killing the vegetation.
Both Ely and Jorgensen say their work provides a baseline on which more science can build. The findings of the study are in the most recent issue of the journal Arctic. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Longtime Juneau Service Agency Southeast Alaska Guidance Association, or SAGA, may not have enough money to keep operating. The nonprofit has 18 AmeriCorps members in Anchorage, Juneau, Seward, Cordova, and Yakutat. It also works outdoors with young people through programs that are now in a state of flux. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When George McGuan joined SAGA's board of directors in March, he had no idea the organization was in a financial hole. He says the board informed him in July that SAGA was $250,000 in debt.
I was blown away. I was like, okay, well, we're a nonprofit. How are we $250,000 in debt? And they just kind of seemed like, well, that's how we operate.
SAGA was founded in 1986 with a mission to foster development through hands-on learning. Its programs, Alaska Service Corps and Connections, brings AmeriCorps members to Alaska. That's how McGuan first came to Juneau in 2005. He says the debt stems from many years ago, but the organization started falling apart this year. McGuan describes the process as people jumping ship.
Our board of directors had our president quit, and the organization itself had three people leave right in the middle of the summer, and then our executive director decided to quit because of the stress level. So we were kind of left holding the bag there with no real organization left.
SAGA staff who left included an office coordinator and finance manager. When executive director Beverly Schoonover gave her letter of resignation in July, McGuan says the board tried at first to find a replacement, but that search has stopped. Schoonover left in October for a state job after 2.5 years with SAGA. Longtime employee Justin Fantasia also left around the same time. He had worked for SAGA since 2003. Most recently, Fantasia was the manager of SAGA's House Build program, a partnership with Juneau Douglas High School, the school district, and Juneau Housing Trust. Its goal is to build affordable housing.
I was just really concerned that there wasn't going to be a transition from executive director to executive director, and that there was a lot of uncertainty whether the organization is going to continue on. I was not formally in a director position, but it wasn't a leadership position. I didn't want to find myself at the helm when things were going down.
SAGA's AmeriCorps program, Connections, is funded through next September. The federal grant of $250,000 goes through the state commission, Serve Alaska. SAGA's board has been trying to find another organization to take over Connections and its AmeriCorps members. Lawrence Blood with the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, which supports Serve Alaska, says any nonprofit or city government would be eligible, but a transfer would have to be approved.
Hopefully, the discussions that the board is having has as little impact on the members as possible. And if it does change to a different organization, we hope to make that process as seamless as possible.
Fantasia describes SAGA's turbulence as a culmination of many factors associated with the nonprofit world: the roller coaster of grant funding, the administrative burdens of grants, and the high turnover of staff. Acting board chair Matt Smith says the board is fighting as hard as it can to keep SAGA alive, but doesn't know if it'll be operating after this year. When asked if he feels any responsibility for SAGA's current trouble, Smith had no comment. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The Bethel Winter House provided overnight shelter and hot meals to the homeless living in Bethel last winter. Board members want to open the homeless shelter at the beginning of December, but have to overcome some challenges first. KYUK's Charles Enoch has the story.
Eva Melvitch is the president of the Bethel Winter House, or Uksumi Ukizvik Inupik. She says before they open, they have to find and train enough volunteers.
We need a minimum of 60 based on how we did last year, and we are having a heck of a time getting people to sign up. If we don't have 60 people signed up by the end of November, we are going to have to meet as a board and decide whether we can open it or not.
Melvitch says according to their policy, there will have to be 2 volunteers each night to run the shelter. She says volunteers will work twice per month, overnight, from 9 p.m. until 7 a.m. Last year, Melvitch says they ran the shelter with 20 volunteers and that wasn't enough. They were overworked and burnt out. She doesn't want that to happen again. As of this week, Monday, 10 volunteers have been trained so far. That leaves 50 more that have to be trained by the end of the month. With winter ahead, Melvitch says the community needs to get more involved for the 100 or so homeless living in Bethel to have a safe, warm place to stay.
The whole purpose for this winter house is to prevent death by exposure for people in this community. There is no reason why somebody should die from exposure because we're in the 21st century. We have a big group of people in this community that experience homelessness. Last year, there was a count of 100 people, and 36 of those are children. It's a community solution to a community problem.
Melvitch says the shelter has some good news on the funding front. Winter House officials announced last week that ConocoPhillips is contributing $5,000, the biggest donation yet. That brings the Winter House one step closer to their goal of hiring a part-time volunteer coordinator. There is also a possibility that the shelter will get a $13,500 grant from the state. However, the location of the shelter is still in discussion, says Melvitch. She says they might elect to rotate the shelter church to church like last year, but that's still up in the air. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Veterans were honored yesterday for the time they served the country. One Vietnam veteran in Petersburg has found healing by going back to the country that was once only known to him as a place of danger and destruction. KFSK's Angela Denning reports from Petersburg.
War can hold difficult memories for many veterans.
If you said the term Vietnam, I would think about mud and wet and danger and people getting hurt.
Sam Bungie is a Vietnam vet living in Petersburg. Vietnam was a deadly war, killing over 58,000 American soldiers from the late 1960s through the mid-70s. Those that returned alive were the lucky ones, and Bungie knows it.
I consider that my life after 1969 is borrowed time, and so I try to take advantage of it, enjoy life, and be good.
He was in Vietnam for 1 year, from 1968 to 1969.
After I returned to the States in 69 and got back into real life, I wanted nothing to do with it. You couldn't have dragged me into a Vietnamese restaurant.
It took 40 years to change his attitude. In 2008, when Bungie was reading a veterans magazine, he noticed an announcement about Vietnam veterans volunteering to build schools back in Vietnam. He had long been a volunteer himself as a firefighter in Petersburg, and he was drawn to the idea.
And I said, that sounds like something I'd like to do.
So Bungie decided to return to the place that was a battleground in his mind. He wasn't sure what to expect.
I was anxious because of my previous experience in 68, 69.
What Bungie saw was a surprise. So much had changed.
There's electricity almost everywhere. Roads are improving. New areas are being opened up. For example, my first project was in a place called the Ashau Valley, which is where Hamburger Hill is. And
what does that mean, Hamburger Hill?
Oh, that was a very significant battle in 1969 with the 101st Airborne. When I was there in 1969, it was a free fire zone littered with craters from B-52s, and the only people who lived there were the North Vietnamese Army. And now there's a nice paved road that runs the length of the valley. There are thriving agricultural villages. There's electricity, irrigation, and a lot of the land is under cultivation. So it's quite a nice change.
Bungie believes the process of volunteering was even more beneficial to him than to the Vietnamese who later used the schools he helped build. His memories changed from very negative images to some that are much more positive.
Now, if you say Vietnam, I think about green and crowds and smiling kids. And I was able to replace a lot of nasty, ugly images in my head with contemporary, peaceful and cheerful ones. Vietnam is nowadays a really nice place. It's beautiful. There's an enormous variety in landscapes, some of which are pretty spectacular. The architecture is just fascinating and amazing. The Vietnamese people are very, very friendly.
He says the proper word to describe it is reconciliation. Bungie decided to return to Vietnam 3 more times after the war to build schools in remote villages. Besides the construction work, there were also planned meetings with Vietnamese veterans. He says through translators, they made the best of it. They would sit around a table, introduce each other, eat Vietnamese food, shake hands, and take pictures. He says there was a mutual respect. But there was one particular instance when Bungie feels like he really connected with someone. It was when he was touring around the country after the volunteer work was over.
In 2008, a buddy and I went down south where I had operated also, around Saigon and Tay Ninh. And our driver interpreter took us to a restaurant. And there was a poster on the wall of the lady who was the proprietor of the restaurant, and she was wearing her Viet Cong uniform decked out with medals. This was, of course, after the hostilities had ceased. And she was a local heroine of the Viet Cong Women's Battalion. And I had operated right in that area for 6 months in 1968. And we agreed that we'd probably shot at each other. And we were both happy that neither of us had gotten hurt. And we were happy to see each other being prosperous now.
The volunteer group that Bungie was involved with was around for 25 years before it disbanded recently. Bungie says it's due to members getting older and having difficulty fundraising. He says he doesn't know if his experience can translate to the modern wars. The wars are just so different. But Bungie hopes that if the conflict in the Middle East ever does pass, then perhaps for some modern-day soldiers, they too can find peace by revisiting their old battlegrounds in the decades to come. Only time will tell. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton and Charles Enoch in Bethel, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.